welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Labor Day is this weekend. Since Labor Day 2017, there's been a lot of major events and news relating to unions and organized labor. Teachers in several states, including West Virginia, demanded and got salary increases and other concessions. Missouri voters overwhelmingly rejected right-to-work legislation that would have required workers in collective bargaining units to pay mandatory fees. However, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against requiring non-union public sector workers to pay fees. Just this week, the Trump administration announced a new agreement with Mexico to replace the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. So what's it all mean for organized labor? Joining us before this Labor Day weekend is Rick Bloomingdale, who is the president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO. Mr. Bloomingdale, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Scott, and it's always a pleasure to be on the show.
Well, thank you. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Rick, I'm going to kind of start at the latest news and work my way backwards here.
Okay.
I mentioned that the Trump administration announced the deal that would replace NAFTA with Mexico this week. The president touted it as a good deal for American workers, manufacturers, farmers, as well as for Mexican workers as well. How do you see it?
Well, the details are scarce, and as President Trump has said, you know, we're willing to work with anybody on fair trade. But before we make a decision on where we stand on this issue, we want us and the public to be able to see the full agreement before it goes before Congress, so everybody knows what the debate is. Obviously, we'd like to see protections for workers in both Mexico and the United States of America. One of the problems with free trade agreements is they always say that they're going to enforce environmental and labor rights, but there's never a mechanism for doing that. So labor rights and environmental rights always get trampled on in these free trade deals. The only mechanism they ever set up was the World Trade Organization to do capital disputes over whose money or intellectual property, never any disputes about workers or the environment. So, you know, we're hopeful, but we obviously want to see the details before we make a decision on where we stand on this trade issue.
Enforcement is one of the big issues and one of the big criticisms of NAFTA. Enforcement of NAFTA rules in America or in Mexico?
Both. We want to see Mexican workers rise up. If their wages go up, ours will go up. When it becomes about competing for low wages, when companies move because wages are lower, then everybody suffers, right? There's a downward pressure on wages when that happens. So if Mexican workers' wages go up, and you know, one of the things that led to the immigration issue was NAFTA drove hundreds of thousands of Mexican farmers off their land. Well, they needed to make a living. So where did they go? They came here to do the kind of agricultural work, a lot of them, that they've done in the past. So it was a disaster because we did nothing for to help Mexican farmers. We did nothing to help our own farmers or our own workers in that trade deal.
Mm-hmm. As you said, details are scarce so far. The president has a habit sometimes of announcing these things without a lot of details. But what do you know about it so far? I heard Rich Trumka, the president of the union nationally, AFL-CIO, nationally talking a little bit about it. But what do you know about the scant details so far?
Very little, Scott. It's not, you know, they did a little bit of a call yesterday. A lot of the issues that we want to see in the agreement, we don't know if they're there or not. So I really can't comment any further than that on what's in it, or because I just don't know.
So what are the details that you want to see?
Well, like I said, enforcement, and I don't have it with me, but we have a 17-point, our trade people in D.C. have a 17-point plan that they'd like to see in any improved NAFTA agreement. Enforcement's a big part of that. Public disclosure is a big part of that, as well as, you know, the whole details of how you treat capital and intellectual property and all that. You know, like I said, I'm not a trade expert. That's why we have folks in D.C. who do that. So those are some of the – we can certainly make sure your listeners, we can send it to you for your website, the 17 points we want to see in the trade deal. But like I said, I'm not an expert on that, that particular issue.
So other than in enforcement, low wages would seem to be one of the real sticking point, that Americans lost jobs – companies that went to Mexico where workers are not paid as much. Is that the biggest criticism, NAFTA, or what are the criticisms other than enforcement?
Well, just like you said, it's a low-wage strategy, right? We lost hundreds of thousands of garment workers to Mexico, and then the wages in Mexico weren't low enough, so they went to Vietnam and Bangladesh and Malaysia and all the places that they go now. So, you know, that there are always going to be folks who chase the low wage. And what we have to do in trade agreements is make sure that, just like they do in Europe, workers are protected against that kind of unfair competition. America's the only country that really tried to ever do free trade. No other company does. They all have provisions for protecting their workers. So we have a lot of work to do in terms of NAFTA. But wages and environmental regulations, right? I mean, if they're not doing clean air or clean water, which are very necessary to good health and safe workplaces, you know, that it's, but it's also a cost to do that on your plants. I mean, the long-term cost, actually it's a savings long-term, but short-term cost they didn't want to pay. So they go to a places where they can dirty the air, dirty the water, and pay the people crap. And, you know, that's that low-wage strategy, and that's why we fought so hard against NAFTA and TPP and all those other unfair trade agreements. We're for trade, but we're for fair trade. We want to see people benefit from decent wages and a middle-class lifestyle.
What does Europe do to protect its workers?
Well, their trade agreements always have protections. And again, this isn't my area of expertise. Mm-hmm. But you know, they always have things that, in terms of retraining and moving there, it's never a disaster, right? A plant closes and all of a sudden you have 1,000 people left out of work. You know, they take great care to make sure that workers are re-educated, retrained, get the information they need, get the skills they need. To move in a kind of, because look, work is constantly evolving. We know that, right? There used to be 3,000 horseshoers in Pennsylvania in the Horseshoers Union. There's 19 now.
Are they unionized, by the way?
They are.
That's good.
But, you know, so work constantly changes. And, you know, some countries are better at keeping up with that change and making sure that their workers are treated like assets, not liabilities. Too often, American corporations treat their company, their employees like liabilities rather than assets.
Before we get into talking about the big picture of organized labor, this issue is one in which your union and other unions support the Trump administration. Politically, that hasn't happened a lot in the past where, even in 2 years and when Donald Trump was a candidate. So, but at the same time, and I don't want to get a long-winded question here, but, you know, the narrative has been that the president was elected by a lot of American workers who felt left behind. Those would seem to be the same people that either you represent or you want to represent to make their lives better, make their work lives better as well. So politically, where are you with the Trump administration?
We'll work with people who will work with us, right? I mean, we've been fighting against bad trade deals since they started. And NAFTA was the most visible that we really started, and was really the biggest where we started organizing against it. We were glad to see that somebody picked up that, you know, that campaign issue. But again, we'll work with those who work with us, and if we'll call them out when they don't work with us. If this is another bad trade deal with a new name, we'll certainly call out the president and tell him it's another bad trade deal with a new name. You know, but if it's a good trade deal, we're going to say it's a good trade deal.
What about tariffs? The president imposed tariffs on steel and aluminum. It's had a ripple effect. Don't know if the United States is in a full-blown trade war yet, but other countries have retaliated, and it has had a negative impact on some industries in this country, agriculture in particular. So your thoughts on the tariffs that the administration has implemented?
You know, I you're really out of my wheelhouse here, Scott. Look, I'm not an expert in trade or tariffs. We fight for those fairness issues every day. And if tariffs are a tool, which is what they are, to level the playing field for workers, then they should be used. But the intricacies of trade, again, that's not my area of expertise, but it's a tool in leveraging fair trade. And it should be used when it does it and when it works. And when they don't work, they shouldn't be used. But like I say, it's like a carpenter and his hammer or, you know, his or her tools. That's all they are tools to help level the playing field on trade.
Do you know, and if you don't, I understand, but do you know whether Pennsylvania, the steel industry, has benefited from the tariffs?
I think they have. I know in some, well, it's a mixed bag. Some areas they're hiring and some areas they're not. So, the issue with tariffs is, I guess, it's a kind of a push-pull. When you add it on one industry, look, we are in a global economy, so everybody uses other people's stuff. So, you know, when you're making raw steel, I think tariffs help. But when you're building something using other components,
a car, for example,
yeah, I think tariffs are going to have a mixed bag effect on that. And that's where fair trade and making sure that we make cars in America, those aren't tariffs. Those are, component, percentages and all that other kind of stuff. That's fair trade is really where you want to be. Tariffs are just a tool to get to a fair trade agreement.
Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about where labor is right now, the state of unions, in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today is Rick Bloomingdale, who is president of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO. We're going to talk about the state, the status of organized labor today in just a moment. If you have a question or a comment, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Rick, I kind of took you by surprise there when I was asking about those specific trade issues, but the real reason that the main gist of our conversation today, pre-Labor Day, was kind of this overarching conversation about the state of labor today. So here's your opportunity to kind of address that, the state of labor on this Labor Day 2018. How do you see it?
Well, and thank you, Scott. And trade is an incredibly important issue. So, I'm glad we had a little bit of time to explore that. But I think the state of labor, as you mentioned in your opening, is in good shape. Obviously, our membership isn't where we would like it to be, but there's growth happening. We have over 250,000 members join the labor movement, not just in Pennsylvania, but all over the country. That was a net gain, so that took into account retirements and, plant closings and that kind of stuff. So we had a net gain of over 250,000 members.
Nationally,
the U.S. 75% of those were people under 35. So there's a real interest, and Gallup came up with a poll today, or maybe last night, but labor has its highest approval rating than we've had in years. Over 60% of folks approve, both Democrats and Republicans approve of what the labor movement does. So, and you had the successful strikes in Arizona and West Virginia, Oklahoma.
The
teachers. And, of course, the great victory in defeating right to work in Missouri. And, there's just like right before Labor Day, some great news. University of Illinois came out with a study that said, and we knew this, that when union workers do well, so do non-union workers, because other companies don't want to lose their workers to unionized facilities, so they tend to raise their wages when the union facility down the street gets a raise. So what we do has always benefited workers in what is really a rigged economy. We've had this opportunity, you know, we had this tax cut that was supposed to go to the workers and never did. Went to stock buybacks. I think AT&T gave their workers a bonus of 1,000 and then announced that they were laying off 40,000 workers. AT&T could have given people a bonus of $100,000 with the tax cut that they got, and it would have been a drop in the bucket. But you know what workers, what unions do is if a place is unionized, then we bargain for a piece of that tax cut, right? Like U.S. Steel is in tough bargaining right now, but you know the workers are saying, "Wait a minute, you just got a tax cut from 35% to 21%. We've been taking concessions for years. Now it's our turn because we've made you productive. We've made the best steel in the world. You need to give some of that back to us because we do the work that makes the product that you sell on the markets. Not just the shareholders should benefit, but the workers as well, the ones who actually make the product. So that's what unions do, and we've seen more and more people starting to realize that this economy really can benefit from unionization, right? We're the ones pushing for, you know, a higher minimum wage, whether it's $15, which we're pushing for, you know, Governor Wolf pushing for $12. Either one of those is still at the low end of what people can really live on. I mean, when you think about it, you know, $7 an hour is $14,000 a year. I don't know anybody that can live on $14,000 a year. $10 an hour is, you know, $20,000 a year if you're working full-time. And so that's why we see so many people working two or three jobs. And, you know, I go back to, you know, Sam Gompers and his famous phrase, what does labor want? You know, we want more time to enjoy the better things in life, more schools and less jails. You know, all those kind of things that we got away from. We started building more jails and fewer schools. What does that tell us about a society? So we really do need more and better schools. We've seen lots of crumbling infrastructure. We need, you know, time to spend with our families. And that means, you know, maybe a 40-hour work week, not an 80-hour work week, right, or two jobs. Those are the kinds of things that the labor movement fights for and will continue to fight for. That's what we do. Yeah.
There's a lot there in just what you said, and I have a lot of questions. But you said that the poll that showed 60%, both Democrats and Republicans, that do approve, that would be good news for organized labor. You also said that membership is not where you would like it to be. I saw a figure that said 1955, 1 in 3 American workers were members of unions. Today, it's around 10%. I don't know whether, you know, you said you added 250,000 across the country, but in the scope of things, considering the number of workers, that's not a lot. I mean, that's still nothing to sneeze at. So why then have we gone from, in 60 years, to granted, a lot of things have changed, from 1 in 3 to 1 in 10?
Well, in Pennsylvania, it's actually a little higher, about 13%. But, you know, the economy, and it's not the weather, right? Rules were changed to make it easier to move overseas. Congress passed rules giving people tax credits for moving overseas. These weren't decisions that people said, oh, we're going to go. You know, there was money-making abilities to move your corporations overseas, your production overseas. So, you know, and Americans just thought, well, that's globalization. But rules are being made every day that impact workers and cheat workers in this economy and to destroy unions, to undermine unions. Janus is a perfect, you know, example.
And we're gonna talk about that in a few minutes, yeah.
But those are the kinds of things. Look, these rules are being made to make people richer, not to expand the middle class. You're right. And what did we have in the 50s? We had the expansion of the middle class from post-World War to, you know, people buying houses. We built the interstate highway system. We started building the space, you know, space capsules. And America had such a great vision of what we could be because we had the will to build the infrastructure to do that. And because unions were organized, 1 in 3 workers, 33 for 35% in Pennsylvania, in the 50s, you saw a huge expansion of the middle class from, you know, pre-World War II, when there wasn't much of a middle class, to where we became the envy of the world. And that's what America was. We were a shining light, right? And then the rules started to change, mostly in the 80s, when President Reagan fired the Patco workers. We started to see a change in the way the economy was rigged, and it's been rigged against workers. And that, you know, one thing, President, you know, that's been our message. President Trump grabbed it, and, you know, there are a lot of workers who said, yeah, this economy's rigged, and it's still rigged. And he rigged it even worse against workers, unfortunately, with that, you know, the tax cut that doesn't really benefit workers much. It benefits the wealthy who were supposed to trickle down, and we know trickle down hasn't worked ever since it was devised. And, you know, I'll never forget Senator Harkin from Iowa. I used to say, look, he was a farmer. You never fertilized crops from the top down. You always fertilized them at the bottom. And that's what, you know, you give workers money, they're going to spend it. They don't put it in the Cayman Islands, right? They go buy a new car or a refrigerator, or they buy a house or new shoes or clothes for kids as school gets ready to start. You give workers that money, they're going to build the economy. And again, that's what unions did. We made sure that when a company was making money, and by the way, when companies weren't, we gave concessions. So this wasn't about driving people out of business. This was about making sure that when companies were doing well, that workers did well.
Some did. I mean, that was, we all are very familiar with some of the fights that went on, that where a company would say, you know, if we give these concessions that, you know, you get the kind of raise we're talking about, unless you take concessions, that we will go out of business or we will move overseas. Now, I'm not here to debate, you know, the positives and negatives of unions, but to just talk about some of the things that people have said over the years and theories on it. When you talk about Congress making rules that have made it easier to move overseas, you know, I know you've heard this criticism. Some people say, well, the reason they did that is because unions, they were paying so much in their workers so much that they could, okay, put it, when I say so much, that makes it sound like they were getting rich, that no. They could move overseas and make a bigger profit, and that's what corporations are there to do.
Well, and that's however you define corporations. Some people say corporations only reward their shareholders. That's the only reason they exist. Mm. I don't believe that. I believe corporations, if they're making a product, ought to provide workers with a decent living wage in order to buy the products, right? Henry Ford, who was no friend of unions, believed that if he didn't pay his workers enough, they weren't going to buy his cars. And again, you know, these companies, look, they could have kept paying those workers those wages, but you're right, they got greedy. They wanted to move overseas, so Congress changed the rules for them, right? And, you know, that's the narrative. Oh, the unions drove. Look, unions don't make corporate decisions. Unions didn't decide that, you know, if a steel company wasn't making competitive steel, that was a management decision. That wasn't a union decision. So this idea that somehow unions drove companies overseas is bull. Just didn't happen. I mean, corporations took advantage of the rewriting of the rules of the economy and moved their production out of the country to try to force wages down, and they have. Wages have been stagnant in this country for 30 years. Even more so in 10 years. I talked to a friend who, our Secretary Treasurer, Frank Snyder, who drove a truck at the steel mill. And back then, he was making about $40,000 a year. And then this was in the 90s. You know what a truck driver makes now? Mm. About $40,000 a year, unless they put on a lot of miles and do an 80-hour week, right? So talked to a friend who was a welder. He started welding in the 80s, 10 bucks an hour. They're trying to get welders now at 10 bucks an hour. And he's come, well, we need skilled folks. What do you need them at? If you pay them $30 an hour, you can probably get a few skilled welders.
Well, I see that. Right? And welders, for example, that's one of the careers or jobs we hear that the salaries are going up because there are so few of them out there. But when you talk about stagnant wages, when we came out of the Great Recession in 2008 and the economy, at least the numbers, started getting better, one of the things that was described as a phenomena in this economic recovery is that jobs were slow to come back. They have now. I mean, we have very low unemployment rate. But wages were stagnant. Wages didn't grow. And I don't want to answer the question for you, but I mean, one of the reasons we've heard is that because there wasn't enough union strength, that's one of the reasons that wages stayed stagnant. What do you say to that?
That's as good an answer as
well. See, I didn't want to answer the question for you.
But
that was as softball as you're going to get, Rick.
That was, that's probably as true a reason as any. I mean, again, the economy is not fair to workers. And as a result, we've had, there was no pressure on corporations to pay their workers more, right? That's what we do as unions. We sit across the bargaining table and say, look, you made this much money this year because our productivity went up. We're making more widgets per hour than we were last year. Therefore, you made more money. We should be rewarded for what we do. Now, an individual can go to the boss and say that, and the boss can say, well, the other 90 people did it too, so I'm not going to give you a raise. But if you have collective action, where people get together in a union and sit across from the boss and say, look, we made your company more money because our productivity went up. We should share in the additional profits. That's what unions do, and wages would go up because that company didn't want to stop working or didn't want to have some kind of job action, grievance, whatever the mechanisms we have. Striking being the last resort, weapon of last resort. But that's what we do. We bargain for higher wages. It is one of the things, and safe workplaces, and a whole lot of other things. Just a voice at work. Not getting, Pennsylvania is an at-will state unless you're a unionized company. A boss can walk in and fire you for having a new tattoo if he wants to in a non-union workplace. Can't do that in a unionized workplace.
But at the same time, as I said, this was one of the explanations of why wages have stayed stagnant. If American workers do that, why isn't there this great rush to unionize then?
Well, again, they've made it hard, right? I mean, one of the things that corporations fear the most is workers talking to workers. You look at Amazon, right? They, in their warehouses, they time their workers' bathroom breaks. There's no discussion with other workers in the warehouse. You can't. There's no. Can't take a minute to go to the water cooler and
now,
say.
How do they time bathroom breaks?
I think they wear. Things.
Are you kidding me? I mean, that sounds a little far-fetched.
Look, in Nike in Vietnam, now that's not America, there are people who are making, now this was before Nike got challenged and changed their practices, but the Vietnamese women that used to sew those tennis shoes had cans by their sewing machines, and that's where they went to the bathroom. And that's and
okay. You know, that's Vietnam, though.
Yeah,
if that happened in America, somebody go to jail.
Yeah. Don't be so surprised that there are sweatshops in America, but with Amazon, the stories were starting, and it's anecdotal. The stories we're starting to hear out of those warehouses are pretty horrific. Well, in Allentown, outside. One of the ventilator fans stopped working last summer. They had an ambulance out there every day for people who had a heat stroke. Now OSHA finally got involved and they had to fix it. Again, that was something OSHA, the labor movement did, fought for OSHA. So there's still, without unions, there are workplaces that are getting worse and worse in America.
We have a listener from Montour County who says, what's changed since the 80s in labor law? Corporations had the right to lock out striking employees, have had the right to lock out striking employees and replace them with new employees, in essence, pulling the teeth of the unions to strike for benefits. Teachers' unions are the exception to this rule, given its political validity, I should say. So what do you think to the response to that?
I think he makes a great point, and he answered the question much more succinctly than I did. There have been significant changes in the way companies work. Companies used to take labor management very seriously. Now it's more adversarial. In some companies, not every company, by the way. Good companies exist out there. But, yeah, with labor becoming, them using more and more lawyers, instead of, they used to shoot us and beat us with clubs, now they use lawyers to slow down the organizing process. You know, company, especially a place with high turnover like a grocery store, they're hard to organize, although UFCW does it all the time. But because there's turnover, because and sometimes to get a union election, it can take a year with delays and that company lawyers use. And a lot of times, the workers who wanted to organize are gone by the time that that union election comes around. So they've made it very difficult. They use delaying tactics. They, use every legal trick in the book. The National Labor Relations Act was drafted in 1935. It seriously needs to be updated to reflect the workplaces of 2018.
John emails, I agree that the economy has been altered to the detriment of the average worker and the middle class in general. But I remember growing up in the 60s, my father was a factory worker in a union, and his complaint was that they are constantly going out on strike, even though they were making adequate wages and had adequate benefits. He hated to lose the work. Consequently, he was opposed to unions. What will stop unions from achieving their goals and then carrying it further just to justify their existence?
Well, that's always, and we hear that all the time from, members, non-members. But look, a union is the people in the plant. So, if that, and I don't know the situation with that guy's father, but person's father, but, unions can't, you got to have a strike vote. I mean, unions are a very democratic institution if people really take the time to explore what we're all about. A lot of times, though, members won't participate. They don't come to the meetings, and they just, they look and they get the newsletter and say, well, why'd they do that? Well, you have a responsibility. We're a democratic institution. Our officers get elected. I get elected. And our delegates get elected to go to the convention by their local unions. We're the only nonprofit organization in the country that has an entire department, the Department of Labor, dedicated to overseeing our finances, our democracy, and all the other things that we do within our union. We have to file countless financial reports with the Department of Labor. We're a democratic organization. And I know there are folks who, oh, you got too big. But look, the members make the decision on what to bargain for. The members make the decision on when to go out on strike. So if you don't participate, it's like voting. If you don't participate, well, you're going to get what you get. Members got to participate in their union. They're not going to it's not run by guys on the outside, right? There's a staff rep. But all he does is, or she does, is advise and provide information. It's the members in the union that make the decisions.
But let's use John's example, though. Who decides what's adequate? I mean, apparently his father thought that he had a good job, was making good money, had good benefits, but the union wanted more. Who decides what's adequate and what's good, what's not?
John's dad would have, is a participant in his union. Right? I don't know how many, let's say 100 people work there. But if only 50 of them go to the meeting, then those 50 decide what's adequate. If John's father thought they were adequate and went to the meeting and, said, hey, I think we make enough, we shouldn't strike, well, there's a vote. And if the majority, in a democracy, majority rules, if the majority said, we don't think it's adequate, we're going on strike, we think the company made more so we can, maybe we can get another day off, or maybe we can get another, 50 cents an hour or a dollar towards our health care or money into the pension. It's the members who make those decisions. So, if the union went on strike, it was because those members in that union decided that they needed to go on strike. The staff, they can go in and make give advice and, show them the company's books and, but in the end, it's the union, the members of that union, who make that decision.
having a listener who wanted to get this in right before the end, saying, yes, production workers and warehouses are time for everything done, even restroom breaks. I work in a warehouse, America's Sweatshops. Companies have tactical training for leadership to prevent employees from unionizing. Rick, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. There's so many other things we can talk about. We didn't even get to Janus decision. But thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, Franklin and Marshall College political analyst and pollster Terry Madonna joins us to talk about the latest F&M poll that is out today. Takes a look at the race for governor here in Pennsylvania, the U.S. Senate race, where President Trump's job performance stands in the opinion of Pennsylvanians. That's all coming up tomorrow morning on Smart Talk. You know, many Americans don't have a vast knowledge of the nation's history and maybe know even less about the period when America won its independence from Great Britain. In school, we learned about the highlights like the Boston Tea Party, Lexington and Concord, the Declaration of Independence, Washington crossing the Delaware to take Trenton, and finally Yorktown. But there is much, much more to the story, and it's described in a new book. And the title says it all, Rethinking America from Empire to Republic by John Murren. Mr. Murren can't be with us today, but historian Andrew Shankman of Rutgers University in Camden is. He has contributed to the book as well. Professor Shankman, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number is 1-800-729-7532. Let's start with the title because, as I said, it probably provides a good overall description of the content of the book, Rethinking America from Empire to Republic. Why do we have to rethink America?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And the title, I think, really comes organically from the life work of John Murren, who was my PhD advisor, which is how I got involved in this project. And this book is a collection of some of the best essays that he's written over the years that have been very significant for historians, but aren't necessarily known to a wider audience. And in many ways, what the book does and what John Murren's work did is force people to confront a fundamental assumption that they have about the American Revolution, which is quite wrong. And because they have this assumption and they usually get it wrong, everything that they think after that usually goes in the wrong direction. So fundamentally, I confront this every other year when I teach the Revolution. Fundamentally, I think a lot of students come into my classes and a lot of people go to things like the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia or Independence Hall when they go on vacation, and they think they know why the American Revolution happened. And the assumption is that slowly and steadily over a number of decades, Americans began to become very, very distinctly American in the 13 colonies. They began to feel that they were very much not British people. And by 1776, there was just no other way to go, and it was just inevitable that, of course, they couldn't be ruled by people who were so different from them. And in fact, what Murren and other scholars have done, and what historians now understand after all of this careful research, is that, in fact, it's almost precisely the opposite. That over the course of the 18th century, those living in British North America began to think of themselves ever more fully and completely as British subjects, fully committed to and loyal to the British Empire and the British monarchy and the British system of government of king cooperating with Parliament. And it was precisely because they were so convinced of their own Britishness that in the 1760s, when the British Empire and government very late in the day began to radically change the way it treated the colonists, they could think that they weren't being treated the way that British subjects should be treated and began to demand their very British rights, which they saw the British government itself as violating. Mm. And so once you understand that for most of their lives, the founding fathers that we know and revere didn't expect to fight a revolution, didn't expect to have to leave the British Empire, and in fact wanted to stay within the British Empire, then we suddenly have a much better understanding of why the very unexpected American Revolution was as radically disruptive as it was and why it led to so many unexpected transformations that we then have to account for.
In fact, in the book, it states, what started as a constitutional argument became a full-blown war for independence. Right. I'm sure there are several different examples of constitutional arguments, but explain what Murren is arguing there.
Sure. So, and what he means by this is not the American Constitution, which wouldn't exist
right.
For 20 years. What he means is that, over the course of the 18th century, British-speaking people living in England, living in Scotland, living in the North American colonies, began to have a real sense of pride in a political system they felt was superior to those of their competitors, primarily the French and the Spanish. And they also wrapped up what they thought was a superior religion, the Protestant religion, to the French and Spanish Catholics. And one of the things they would have pointed to as to why their political system was superior would have been that they would have said that they have what they called a constitution. Now, we think we know what a constitution is. We think it's a written document, and for us it is. But that's actually an innovation that comes as a result of the failure of the British Empire. What the British meant by a constitution was just simply a set of fundamental values and standards that everybody could agree upon, which wasn't necessarily written down in any one place, but was the sum total of sort of the best practices and best experiences, some of it written law, some of it customary tradition, some of it going back as far as the 1215 statement Magna Carta, which some people may have heard of, in which nobles tried to limit the king's power. But fundamentally, what this meant for the colonial Americans was that there were certain British liberties that the British government protected that everybody should have, whether they were British or not, but that only the British government actually managed to protect, and that fundamentally those were the rights to life, liberty, and property. That the government should not be able to forcibly take your life from you. It should not be able to prevent you from using your life with the liberty that allowed you to pursue your best interests as best you could. And in pursuing those best interests, if you were able to secure property, you should be secure in its protection. And fundamentally, what that meant for the colonists was that because they lived so far away from British government and didn't therefore, say, get to send representatives to the parliament to directly advocate for themselves, that parliament should understand that because they were British subjects, that parliament itself, the British legislature, had to see limitations to its own authority over them. Fundamentally, that it shouldn't tax them. And it shouldn't tax them because the only way that the power to tax would be contained and not lead to the dangerous threat to property was if two things were true. The first, that those who were doing the taxing had to be chosen by the taxpayers. And the second was that those who were doing the taxing were obligated to pay the same taxes they required other people to pay. If both of those things were true, then those who were doing the taxing would never tax in dangerous ways because they could be voted out and also because they would be injuring themselves since they'd have to pay the same taxes. Hmm. And that could work very well within Britain, but since colonists living 3,000 miles in an ocean away didn't get to send people to Parliament, neither of those things were true. They didn't get to elect taxpayers. And a taxpayer living in Britain, if he imposed a tax on, say, Pennsylvania, wouldn't have to pay that tax. So here was a constitutional constraint, they argued, which if British people respected their own traditions of protecting life, liberty, and property, would understand that they shouldn't extend the taxation power to the colonies. Now, one mistake that I think a lot of people make is that colonists were against the idea of taxation. They weren't at all. What they said was that their own colonial legislature should be the ones to do the taxing, because in that instance, both those things were true. If you live in Pennsylvania, you do elect people to your own legislature, and those legislators have to pay the same taxes they'd expect you to pay. So, in fact, colonial Americans paid a lot of taxes. What they objected to was that there would be no constraint on the process of taxation. And when that began to happen in the 1760s, this was the constitutional argument they were having, which they fully expected, once they explained themselves, their fellow British subjects, who cared for liberty just as much as they did, would understand, would acknowledge the validity of their arguments, and then would respect their British liberties and stop violating this British constitution.
You know, the French and Indian War, when we talk a lot about, when we have spoken a lot about the causes of the American Revolution,
right,
often it's pointed to as the French and Indian War, that once Britain defeated France, that it was inevitable that America would get its independence, would fight for its independence.
Right.
And in the book, it's argued against that. But
yeah,
how the French and Indian War, and I want to make sure this is accurate, did come into play here is that taxation that you just talked about. The narrative has been that Britain needed to pay for that war and that taxing the colonists was a way to do that. So talk about, there's two different questions there.
Sure.
One is that Americans would seek their independence after the French and Indian War, and two, that taxation was a result of having to pay for that war.
Right, right. Yeah, that's really good. And those two questions are actually related, so you sort of will address them both at the same time. So, right, in one of the essays, Morin, I think, demolishes the argument that because Britain, with the extensive support from the North American colonies, did defeat the French in what we call the French-Indian War, which was also called the 7 Years' War, and as a result was able to then conquer all of Canada, which had been French prior to that, Morin really demolishes the argument that because of that success and the removal, therefore, of the French threat. The old argument used to be, well, the Americans no longer needed British protection from the French because the French were defeated, and so therefore there was nothing to stop them from seeking independence. So Britain, Murren, I think, really successfully demolishes that argument in one of the chapters. But then that leads to the bigger question, which is, well, okay, well, then why did things disintegrate so quickly afterwards, and what connection did this incredible victory over the French have with 12 years later the coming of the revolution? And there is a connection. And it has a lot to do, you're right, with the need to pay for things in taxation. But if we dig deeper, we see that none of what happened in 1776 was inevitable because of the French and Indian War, which ended in 1763. So, for example, during the war, and the French and Indian War, the Seven Years' War, is one of a series of wars that the British and French had fought, really starting in 1688. And it's the biggest and the most expensive. And it's really is a world war. It takes place on the oceans. It takes place in Europe. It's fought in North America. It's even fought in the Indian subcontinent. It's very costly and very expensive. The British public debt almost doubled as a result of this war. And so early on, the British wanted the American colonists to contribute to the costs of the war. And fundamentally, what the British wanted was the American colonists to do three things. One is they wanted them to contribute some of the cost for paying for the troops, and not just British troops, but also raising their own colonial troops. And then secondly, they wanted them to pay for the cost of what's called quartering the troops, building barracks, housing them, feeding them. And then third, what they wanted was the American colonists to respect and obey a British-dominated military chain of command. And what they meant by that was that ultimately, just in Massachusetts, there were about 20,000 to 25,000 men under arms fighting the war. And the way it worked in Massachusetts was that these men would be formed by companies basically from their villages. And then a village elder, a sort of prominent figure in the village, would be chosen to be an officer. And by tradition, the highest rank that a colonial officer could achieve would be colonel. But what the British wanted was a military chain of command in which every colonial officer, regardless of rank, would obey every British officer. So even if you're an American provincial colonel, you have to obey a British, young second lieutenant, say, for example. So that's three things they want. They want the Americans to pay for the costs of the war, help pay for the cost of the war. They want them to quarter troops. They want them to obey a military chain of command. Mm. And what happens during the French and Indian War, and I'll talk briefly about it, is that the Americans actually very enthusiastically, by the end of the war, do all of those things. And the way that they do all of those things is that a very brilliant, what we today would call prime minister, a man named William Pitt, and listeners should realize, William Pitt, well, that's who Pittsburgh is named for, that's who Pittsfield, Massachusetts, he's a very popular figure. People name towns after him in colonial America. It's not they automatically dislike British leaders. What Pitt decides is that, in fact, the American colonists are true British subjects. They do have British liberties. There is a British constitution. And they shouldn't be taxed by people who don't represent them. And yet, he says, we still need them to raise revenue. And so what he does is he essentially goes to all of the colonial governors who are appointed by Pitt, and he says to them, I want you to go to the colonial legislatures. The legislatures are elected by colonial Americans. And offer them this deal, which is that if they voluntarily tax themselves, we're not going to make them do it, and they can choose not to do it, but if they voluntarily tax themselves, we will reimburse a portion of what they have taxed themselves with colonial paper currency. We'll reimburse them with gold and silver from Britain. And for reasons that are interesting and complex, and if someone wants to ask me about it in Q&A, they can, gold and silver is scarce in the colonies, and that's a very desirable thing for the colonists to have. And the result is, with that incentive, they voluntarily tax themselves at record levels. And he makes the same offer with the cost of quartering the troops. He says, if you pay for build barracks, if you quarter the troops, if you provide them with room and with board, will again reimburse you a portion of the cost in gold and silver. Mm. And with the military chain of command, he says, well, you know what? Given that these sort of leading villagers in these colonies, these older men who by this point have fought in probably two wars, are real veterans with real military experience, I can understand why they would lose face and it wouldn't be reasonable for them to be embarrassed before their men by being ordered around by young, untried British officers. At the same time, we do have to sort of preserve a British military chain of command. And so what he innovatively does is he creates a new rank in the British Army, which is called Colonel in America Only. And he raises each British officer in a command position. So, for example, if there's a British unit connected to an American provincial unit, and that British unit has a major and two captains and three lieutenants, he raises the major to the rank of Colonel in America Only.
Hey, Dr. Shankman.
Yeah.
We don't have enough time.
I'm sorry.
Can we come back? come back because there's a lot more to discuss.
Yeah, well, let me just cut to the chase, which is that all of the things that he gets them to do, pay for the troops, pay for the cost of the war, and really by the end of this relationship, respect the British military chain.